$155 million wonderland. As if by magic, 1,216 acres of wasteland have been transformed into the most stupendous exposition the world has ever known.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness the most excitingly different new concept in the history of television.
So you see, folks, all of you who are living in the year 2000 are fortunate.
I think it was back in 1944, wasn't it, Mother?
That's the most remarkable thing I've ever seen.
So yeah, so what were you talking about with therapy?
I joke with Jackie sometimes about how it seems that it you're paying someone to kind of just pretend to listen, but that's enough because it gets you to talk. And it's like almost that the dynamic is what's the help and not always the person sitting across from you.
Yeah, like a lot of the time it can be, you know, you're just talking to somebody. And maybe you're just kind of meandering while you're talking, right? You're just trying to figure out, well, why do I think this way? You know? And then when you really dive in and dig in and you're talking and that third person perspective, they just say like one little thing and then it's like a gear gets loose and you just go and the wheels start turning and then your life starts changing. And that's really where it is. And you don't really get that, like, just from your friends, because your friends are like, oh, she was a whatever, or he was this way.
It's not your fault because
this thing and that thing. Versus it doesn't matter what happened. It doesn't matter what those people did. What matters is how you're going to move forward and how you're going to, like, change what you're doing and change your reactions and what did you learn. Like, that's a completely different dynamic. It's almost like a parenting thing in some ways, which I think like really helps, you know, if you find the right people. And it's not just like, oh man, what a whatever. Okay, see you next week. And, you know, oh, do you want some coffee before you go? It's not like you're paying for a friend. It's not like you're a rapper.
Yeah.
Yo, you like this song, dog? Yeah, dog. And that's it. Like, where's my check? That's what everyone think therapy is. Like if that's what you're looking for, just be a freaking SoundCloud rapper, guys.
Which we aren't yet, but
not yet. No, one day we will be. Yeah. Oh yeah. No. What I'll do is I'll narrate between the tracks, and then you'll like go hard like Dennis Hopper.
Oh yes.
Going on a track.
No, I think my hip hop style would be a Dennis Hopper from Apocalypse Now mixed with like, I don't know, Pharaoh Monk or something. So
when it dies, man. When it dies, man. He dies, man. He dies, man.
Yeah, a little trip hop beat underneath that and boom, Heart of Darkness.
Well, hello everybody. Welcome to Guerrilla Film History Now. I'm Pete.
And I'm Mark.
And this is a show where two film nerds are going to go down a dark alley and try to figure out what happened to that woman on Tuesday. Because this week, we're talking about film noir.
Film noir.
Yeah, and this will be our third attempt at recording it in 3 days.
But it's practice and we are honed, so... we got a streamlined episode for you guys this week. We went a little long.
One hopes.
We went a little long last week, and so we're going to snap this one back a little bit. And but it's going to be fun.
Yeah. Before we get started, do you have anything you want to plug?
I'm at Mark Rubendahl on Instagram. We also got the G Film History Now Instagram. And if you want to check out, I'm working on this other project with a inmate friend of mine. It's called Bard. And I'm doing that with a friend of mine, Kevin Ronka, at Right Brain Studios. So you can check us out there, too.
Awesome. You can find my writing over at dorkdaily.com.
Great site.
I'm your gamer dad.
Love that.
I'm just gonna keep getting sexier and sexier every time I say it. Eventually, it's gonna be daddy. Yeah. one day, it's just gonna turn to daddy. It's just gonna say that.
When the kids are out of the house, you're just gonna have to pivot, and you're just gamer daddy, and you do it mostly with the clothes.
Yeah, kids
off,
are gone, but daddy's home. So you can come over, and I'm gaming with my family. we are looking for writers over at dorkdaily.com. Feel free to shoot us over some messages over on the Facebook. You can find Dork Daily Community. We'd love to have you. It's a great site, and if you're a dork about something, we want to hear about it. The other thing I have to plug is Where Skin Once Was. It is an Amazon exclusive.
Great story.
On Kindle Unlimited. Thank you very much. It's on Kindle Unlimited, and it's free if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber. Otherwise, it's 99 cents. If you read that, that helps to support the show. We're also on Twitter at GFilm History Now. We passed way past 400 at this point.
It's crazy.
And just like, yeah, we started at the end of March. So that's insane to me. We started doing videos, little video snippets and stuff now. We're playing around. We're growing. And it's really, really cool. And we wouldn't be doing anywhere near as much stuff as we're doing or planning on doing without all of your support.
Yes,
so thank you.
Thank you. And yeah, just like, if you remember in episode one, I told you to go yell at your friends to listen. And it seems like some people are doing that. So
yeah,
in some way.
But for the Guerrilla Film Army,
G Film Army,
maybe their homework should be going on some subreddits and posting the episode.
Oh, yes.
Yes. If you're listening right now, go to some subreddits for film noir stuff, film podcasts, film history. Post it around, share it around. See, you know, if you can't recruit some members for our growing field of battle.
we're up in the hills and we're training troops.
Run to the hills.
It's like what
I love Iron Maiden. That album is so good.
You just reminded me of the Mad Max Fury Road with those crazy riffs on the guys swinging on the
flamethrower guitar.
It's so good.
Yeah, and you know what? Why are they doing that if there's no effing gas?
Wow. Yeah.
Shouldn't that be going in the gas tank? They got a good 20 miles left, and you're just burning it?
Well, that might be a negotiation of war.
I get it's an intimidation.
For morale versus for gas mileage. Someone's got to crunch that.
We're going to Valhalla.
Unless we run out of gas, but we'll have good tunes on the way.
Stay chrome, guys. So let's just jump right in. Let's just get going. Let's jump right in, man.
If you've been following us, thank you. The last few weeks we've been discussing the propagandistic capabilities of film. We talked about how governments are able to co-opt not only the tone and mood of these films, of certain films, but the government can take over the entire industry, especially at a time of war. But what was happening outside of that purview, and what was the overall tenor of these films that were able to more or less evade certain government oversights? And what were filmmakers of this era trying to tell us? And while I'm asking vague questions in this tone of voice, what does a snow sled have to do with a fat guy wearing a prosthetic nose and pretending to be a corrupt Mexican police chief? Pour something dark and stumble down a dimly lit studio lot back alley with us, because we're talking noir, darlings. Smoke them if you got them.
I got some lucky strikes over here. Lucky strikes.
They brought those back, I've noticed, at Wawa.
Oh, I've only ever seen candy versions.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, though. I don't know that they were ever, in the last 50 years, a functioning cigarette, but they bring them back for like nostalgia that none of us were around for. Because they were the cigarettes that doctors would smoke on commercials and say, I do it, why shouldn't you?
You don't want to get near all those e-cigarettes. They blow up in your face and it's all the future. It's corporate and they're awful. And, you know, you're doing Nick salts and everything. Why don't you just come back over to Lucky Strike? Just the all natural, an analog cigarette just for you.
Lucky Strike, do you really want to live?
Don't smoke. Please don't smoke. I'm a cancer survivor. Please don't.
Lucky Strike, do you really want to live your life fully?
Lucky Strike, this might be your last one.
Well, I think
looks like Bobby struck out.
He was hit by a pitch and he is not getting back up.
And Bobby McCall's up to the plate and he's got that lucky strike in his mouth. Whoa! Wow, man, just smacked him right in the face. That was
he's not
lucky for him. He's I don't know if you can see that, folks. I know we're a black and white broadcast, but that's a lot of
Let's hope the organ player knows how to play an elegy. But
I'm sorry. Continue.
So yeah, coming back to the ground here, I want to talk about a specific policy that was passed in 1944, because this is going to have huge implications for the next about 20 years. So in 1944, President Roosevelt signed into effect the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, which is usually referred to as the GI Bill of Rights. I'm sure you've probably heard that term, not the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, but it was understood at the time that soldiers returning from World War One they weren't properly taken care of. The government could have done more. The World War One soldiers apparently got a train ticket home and about a $60 stipend, pat on the back, and
God, that's
told
it?
To go. Yeah, get go wait for the Great Depression. Worst times are ahead. Oh. Yeah, so it was. It was a tough.
Oh, jeez! No wonder that No wonder the summer went crazy, because that's the summer of the first Red Scare, right after World War One, right? 1918.
Yeah, because the Bolsheviks just sacked the Tsar. Yeah,
the Bolshevik threat. Yeah. So that's all coinciding at the same time. Oh my gosh!
And so,
and all the labor strikes. That was insane. So they're like, no, we can't do that again.
There's so much of that history of. There's so much history in America that is defined by not wanting to be some other, and at different times there are different threats, and so yeah, those it's important to kind of think of those as like almost forces or gases that get released, right? Because they're now in the atmosphere. So in 1918, when you have a socialist revolution that wins, that is now a possibility. And if you're a leader in America, you're going to look at that and you're going to say, oh, they have czars, but we got presidents, and I don't like what happened to them. So there's going to be – I like to think of it as like a rubber band snapping back. So during times of war, it's an easier opportunity for governments to implement a plan, because people are in more of a desperate situation. Everything is more precarious.
We need to do this for the better of the country,
yeah,
the better of the people.
For national
we need
security.
To do this for the troops.
Yeah, it's for you. And so, yeah, we see all of this. And it infects film, because film is the mirror to culture, right? We can't really sit here and say, does culture inform film or film inform culture? It's we have to look at it as a mirror, because they're happening side by side. So that's why it's important to ground this with the politics in America, because film noir does not happen without the war. And so this GI Bill, when these soldiers were returning and Congress was trying to basically redeem themselves from the First World War, they set out to provide returning veterans with educational subsidies for college or workforce trainings, loans for houses and or farms. And it was actually contested in Congress at the time, so kind of interesting. But unemployment pay for returning veterans, which it almost held the bill up, and it ended up that only 20% of the returning veterans used this unemployment pay. But it was – they had to bring in a Georgia senator to break this tie. And so I just wanted to bring that up, because we understand the GI Bill of Rights to be like, well, the greatest generation was coming home, and they deserve the greatest reward. And this was what was what they were walking back into. And it was an attempt for the country to take them in and say thank you. You can go back and look at those old newsreels, and it makes you a little bit sentimental when the boats are arriving on the shore with the soldiers, and everyone is waving their hats and blowing kisses on the dock.
Yeah, you don't really see that happen again.
No, you see some of the Vietnam footage with soldiers getting off the plane to crowds, but there's just something so dramatic about like the black and white. You have this huge ship coming into shore, and like it seems like the whole country's lined up to say thank you for beating the Nazis.
Well, and with the Vietnam guys, it was 50-50.
Yeah, because
it was either going to be the hometown hero or you're a baby killer.
Yeah, and the Vietnam War, like World War II, these are huge sections of American history or world history in the middle of this cinematic journey which we're talking about. So, yeah, not to belabor the point too much, but you do have to understand the ground that these people were standing on to understand their history. And so that was when the soldiers were returning home. The idea was to get them back into their jobs, right, which the women had taken over.
Yeah.
So women were found working during the war, and this to a large part helped get the economy back to a stable post-depression place, because a lot of historians will say, yeah, that it was World War II that ended up getting us out of the Great Depression, because it just kick-started so much industry.
Well, yeah, and that's really when war becomes an industry in the United States, where we really look at it. Yeah, I mean, like we become the war machine. We really get very, very good at mechanizing and industrializing war.
And advertising it.
A lot of other countries. And advertising it. And a lot, and this is the beginning of it, because we get to go, hey, we're world champions here. We're the ones that came in and saved everybody. We killed Hitler. Right. Not you. Like, that's where we were at. We dropped the bombs. Not you.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, a moment of pride, but it is also a moment of... don't you dare, which kind of pisses off the Russians.
Just a little bit, yeah. To the point where, yeah, they beat us to space, because the space race becomes a consequence of this new kind of Red Scare.
Yeah, because they have to show everybody that they can do just as much as we can.
It's back and forth.
This here is like, you would think, oh, this is this great big hope. There's this whatever, but I feel like a lot of this push was more about, it was about celebrating the return to normalcy. Where a lot of other countries were looking at it and going, a lot of things went wrong here. How do we fix it? How do we change it? How do we make sure that this kind of stuff doesn't happen again? We went, oh, it's never going to happen again because we don't want it to. And we just need to go back to normal and move on and swallow it. And it's like part bragging, but also part repressing.
It's a power move.
And I think it's those two things coinciding where you start to get film noir.
Yes, absolutely. And there's kind of a feeling that pervades over all of film noir. And it's interesting to think that when we dropped the A-bomb, it was a definitive act in a war that appeared at the time to about be over. Historians argue whether or not we even need to drop the A-bomb to win the war. The Japanese...
Yeah, I don't think we did.
But what that did was, it was a power move. It was a flex, right? They had the Manhattan Project. You get all the luminaries of science and physics. And
it was, at that point, I don't think it really was about the Japanese. It was about showing the Germans.
Yep.
I think that's what it was. It was part, they did that to the Japanese because it was a revenge thing. You bombed Pearl Harbor. Now we're going to disintegrate two of your cities. Yeah, like that, it was part that, but it was more, look what we can do, Adolf, be careful. It was, and it's a shame, and it's a travesty that all those people had to die
to make a point, a show, to make a point,
to make
not
a point
even
when
a
really
war.
Like I don't actually think we, it would have been, I understand to an extent where, you know, you don't want to have extra casualties, you don't want to have more men and women on the ground. You don't want to have this, and this happen. What if this goes wrong and it emboldens them? What if this goes wrong? And that seemed like this, you know, blackjack hand, this full house hand that they could do. And it was, but I think, you know, I mean, when you look at the quotes of everybody that worked on that project after they saw what happened, I mean, I think they understood very well that that wasn't actually necessary. And when the people that made it think that way, that's something to consider for yourself when you look at it and go, was it really necessary?
And that's an interesting point, because if we think of, 1945, right, when the mushroom cloud is clearing, we have hundreds of thousands of dead Japanese, which, like we said, could have been avoided probably. But yeah, it was the American strategy to close off that war, and then with the bomb, and then also project the new world power that we had, because this bomb could then be detonated. If you, hey Germany, try it again, we got the bomb. Hey Soviets, you want to make all of Asia communist? Well, we got a bomb. And yeah, it was kind of a way to project empire from the threat of a plane flying over your city, and it completely changed the way these world leaders can think about war. It also changed how filmmakers make film, because it seems that there was this pride, because America was coming out of the war feeling good about itself. But like you said, Pete, if you ask Albert Einstein what he thinks of the bomb he helped make, he regrets it. There's guilt. And that kind of guilt is inherent in film noir. It's always it's like you're – I mean, it's acting out your own death. There's this sense where everyone involved is already doomed, and they know it, but they're doing what the best they can. And yeah, it's a very strange time.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, when you look at some of the films, when they talk about like the femme fatales that were married to like these richer guys that start going for these lower class guys, there's this sense of, especially in early noir, that the return to normalcy wasn't actually a good thing. That, you know, there really was all this repressed stuff and everything, and now everyone kind of has to swallow it and go back to normal and pretend everything's okay. You know, that's tough.
To just make the guerrilla film history now comparison, like if we look at right now with COVID, we're coming into a new world. And it wasn't by an act of war. It was by a virus, but it changed everything. It showed everyone this wasn't an American bomb. This was nature saying, remember me. And it's important to bring up right now that we are living in an age that will define the next 20 years, much like coming out of World War II. And it's not because we're at war, but we're in a crisis situation. And crisis situations have the ability to inform the next generation, because there are things that come from crisis that it's exacerbated.
Yeah. When we were talking about like a return to normalcy, right?
Coming up
with COVID, I think there are people that want to go back to normal. I mean, I certainly want to go back to the way things used to be, but I don't think it's ever going to fully go back. It can't. Because whenever there's a shift in this kind of power, whether it's society-wise, where everyone goes inside when everything used to be outside and used to go to work and now everything's remote, and there's always going to be people that prefer the way things changed and want the world to continue in that direction. And when it shifts back the other way, there's pushback. So when you say like there isn't going to be a war, I don't necessarily think it's going to be like a war like we're going to be shooting and killing each other, like a civil war. But I do think there's going to be an internal war within everybody in the next couple of years, whether it's going to be, you know, well, how do I deal with going back to a world and being like, well, what if everything shuts down again? How do I prepare myself? You're going to have more doomsday kind of prep stuff going on. Well, when's the next virus going to hit? What's this going to happen?
Where's the variants?
Or, you know, but I want to keep living this way. I'm more successful living in this manner. I want to continue being, you know, inside and separated, and this is better for
me. The memes are great.
And there are more.
The memes are great here.
Yeah. 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 The memes are great here. And I got to see all my movies and I got all my work done asymmetrically and I had more time off. And there's going to be people that want that. And I think there's going to be eventually just this kind of molding between and together where everyone's just going to be.
And
a little bit of both.
But
it's going to take a few years of reckoning internally with ourselves and figuring out who we are. Because like we were just talking about therapy right at the beginning.
Yeah.
But like that's what film noir is. It's kind of this weird cisgender male thing.
It's trying to talk about your feelings without talking about your feelings.
But in a manly way, and while it's being censored by the motion picture, called?
The Hays Code, yeah, the MPCA or whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got all that censorship still going on, right? Like that's...
Yeah, oh, that's absolutely. Crazy. Yeah, I mean, and that's where these films, part of their style is... It's like the in-between. It's implying something without showing it. The best example I can think of, and it's not quite a film noir, but it has elements, is A Streetcar Named Desire, Elia Kazan, who directed a couple great noirs himself, including on the...
He's a fantastic playwright.
Yes. He was a McCarthy era snitch as well, and we're going to get to that probably in the next week or two, because he's a complicated figure. Yeah.
Oh, I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Don't ask Arthur Miller what he thinks of Elia Kazan, because they had a falling out over it. But yeah, so Brando goes in the room to. It's basically the implication is a rape scene, but the camera drifts to the light bulb and the light bulb goes out, and you're supposed to understand that as the rape scene. And so because of the cracking down of the Hays Code, you now had to add style it almost helped the art form elevate another level, because now you really had to show not tell on certain things, or you can't even show the sex scene. You have to signal it with a light bulb going out, or the saloon owner.
Like a train going through a tunnel.
Yes, the saloon owner turns out the lights. Yeah, you hear the train in the background, and you know the girl is doomed. And yeah, there's like this inevitability in film noir, and it just kind
of, which we can. Yeah, we'll get more into that after the break, though, for sure.
Yeah,
because I did what I... Yeah, I know. We just started jump right in. That's totally fine, because I did the same thing. But yeah, so we just wanted to do... We thought we'd change it up a little bit this week and do the history first and then do the movie stuff. And I think that this is actually working out a lot better. I think that this is going to be the format going forward. So
yeah, it helps ground us.
Yeah, when we come back, we're going to be really, really digging into all the mechanics of film noir and... what Roger Ebert has to say all about it and everything, too. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a great list.
So yeah, we'll be right back.
See ya.
So Mark was just sitting there, drinking his whiskey and smoking his cigarettes while he was going over his notes, trying to figure out, well, how the hell am I going to talk to this brick-faced, toilet-head-looking chump of a man? Didn't even serve the war. How am I going to talk to him about film noir? How does he know? That's what Mark's thinking.
It's actually not at all what I was thinking, but it was wonderful.
Welcome back, everybody. Yeah, to Girl Film History. Yeah? That was my little noir narration voice there for you. Because that's all it is, right? It's just a bunch of gangster guys that go, man, you know, we don't talk about our feelings.
It's just guys talking about out of the side of the mouths to each other.
Yeah, did you see that broad with the baby?
Pretty much. That line is probably in every other film noir. Check out the broad over there. We're pulling out of the history a little bit here. And just, the soldiers are coming back home. They're getting accommodated. We have suburbs popping up to house this new crop. There's going to be a baby boom, right? And this was anticipated by land developers who built the suburbs because they knew there was going to be a whole generation of 2.6 million men coming home. They're going to be looking for wives, looking for kids, and now they're going to be sold the white picket fence. The oven, the dishwasher, that stuff is. This is where the soldiers are coming into. So that's where the baby boom comes from. We get everyone. There's a 10-year period where everyone's feeling great, having kids. Returning soldiers are accommodated. The economy's booming. The women helped pull it out of the Great Depression by working at factories. Now they're encouraged back into domestic life, and. It's also important to state here that there were black soldiers returning, especially in the South. They were screwed over because that's the country we live in. So they didn't see all these benefits. And that's unfortunate because if you look through film noir, it is very white. It has a lot of European influences.
Particularly German Expressionism is really
German Expressionism
for visual.
Huge.
But yeah, no, there aren't any films that deal with race relations at all, really, right?
In some ways, especially some of the later ones get into it, and actually one that comes in is called Odds Against Tomorrow. I suggest everyone watch it. It's Harry Belafonte, and he helped produce it, and it's a 1959 noir, so
what's
it kind of caps
again?
It all.
Odds Against what?
Odds Against Tomorrow.
Odds Against Tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, and it's just a black guy and a white guy got to come together to do a job for a guy. Of course it goes sideways, but it's great, and it does kind of head on look at the race relations. That was probably a huge part because Harry Belafonte, everyone look him up, he's American treasure, but he wanted that film, he wanted to take the trappings of film noir and do a social conscious piece, which film noir directors were doing a lot, but it wasn't as explicit, which is what this Odds Against Tomorrow movie is, and it's actually outside of the traditional noir time frame, but I think it's actually one of the truest noirs because it gets to the root of things.
Yeah, and that's something else that I think a lot of people that aren't really familiar with film noir is that it's not a genre, right? Like, it's not a horror thing, it's not this or that. You could classify it as crime or a whodunit or whatever, but
detectives, yeah.
But really, film noir is treated more like a time period, kind of like the American New Wave or French New Wave or like the silent era or something like that, where it's a very defined set from right after World War II up until, what, like 1958, 1960 with Faces of Evil?
Yes, yes. It started a bit before the war, but it was informed by wartime politics and wartime like feelings.
Yeah.
But so Roger Ebert, I'm sure you've heard of him. He's one of the greatest film critics of all time. He put together this great, it's a 10-point list of what is film noir. I'm not going to read the whole list, but he kind of adopts the film noir style with his writing. And I'm going to read a couple of the more fun ones. But this is really going to help. You probably know what film noir is just in your soul, because there's a mood to it. It's dark. So this is all going to feel at home for you. So here, the number three is locations that reek of night, of shadows, of alleys, of back doors, of fancy places, of apartment buildings with a high turnover rate, of taxi drivers and bartenders who have seen it all. Yeah, good stuff. And his number six, for women, low necklines, floppy hats, mascara, lipstick, dressing rooms, boudoirs, calling the doorman by his first name, high heels, red dresses, elbow-length gloves, mixing drinks, having gangsters as boyfriends, having soft spots for alcoholic private eyes, wanting a lot of someone else's women, sprawling dead on the floor with every limb meticulously arranged by in place. So that'll give you the idea of how, I mean, film noir objectifies women a whole lot.
And vilifies them in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a great point with the femme fatale.
If you look at a lot of Hitchcock films, which I think he really started cutting his teeth in noir, a lot of his stuff is about like how evil, manipulative, and overbearing women can be. And a lot of that has to do with his own upbringing and his mother, which we'll get
in. And it was,
we'll probably get into.
Fascinated
with
blondes.
Sure, yeah.
The type.
Yeah, he was like 100%. He would have been a serial killer if he had not been a filmmaker. like, it's just him and Lance Armstrong would have both just murdered everybody.
What hell of a tag team.
They would have been the Bonnie and Clyde of
of
the road, of the Tour de France. It's like, wow, we started with 400 racers. I don't know how the hell we got down to 50. Where'd all they go? Where'd they all go? They just got lost in the woods. And why is there all that fog there? And who's that guy with the silhouette? he looks like the penguin.
He's riding on the pegs of Lance Armstrong's bike. Like, yeah, you really.
I can't wait to do an episode about him just because I love that people like latch on to these directors and then you learn about them. And
they're
then
awful.
And they're just these awful people. And they people go, well, I mean, you got to separate the art. No, you don't.
Did the guy join the art to terrify women?
Yeah, because I think he joined the arts because this was a safe place for him to go.
Yeah, it's like being a Catholic priest.
Oh my god. Seriously, that line about the objectification of women is really like 100% true. Like that they really did treat them like shit. And a lot of the time these women were vilified, were sexualized, were punished for, you know, I think from a modern standpoint, a lot of these women are just trying to like have a better life. Like they're getting like hit by their husbands. They don't want to be housewives anymore. They had lives and now they're back to this. And it's like,
it's a hard adjustment.
You know, well, how do I go back after that? And I found out I don't love this man anymore, and I actually love this person. And so there's a lot of also toxic love when it comes to film noir, a lot of toxic, tragic love. And it, the relationships really are 100% toxic every time.
Very. And it's kind of the catalyst of a lot of it. There are, I'm thinking of a couple John Garfield noirs where it, he has like a sweet home life, but then like his wife gets killed. And then so.
Yeah. So even if everything works out fine, it's only sweet to show. Terrible.
Yeah. That how dark it can be on the flip side.
Yeah. You're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know, like the Catholic priest.
Yeah. Play it with fire. We're gonna get struck down. The audio is gonna fail. I want to hit the Ebert line about men too, because
oh yeah, no, we gotta hear about this.
In the way that women were objectified, it you can also see it as they were being empowered, though, because they now have agency and they can kind of make waves in this world of men, because the women aren't doing anything the men aren't trying to do or have already done. It's just that their expectations are different. And so they get vilified, because for men, we have, as Ebert said, fedoras, suits and ties, shabby residential hotels with neon signs blinking through the window, buying yourself a drink out of the office bottle, cars with running boards, all-night diners, protecting kids who shouldn't be playing with the big guys, being on first name terms with homicide cops, knowing a lot of people whose description and an ease, such as bookies, newsies, junkies, alkies, jockeys, and cabbies. And so that kind of, I'm sure if you close your eyes, you're just kind of picturing Humphrey Bogart, because he is kind of the stand-in, at least in America, for film noir. Mm-hmm. But yeah, one of those guys that can seemingly go anywhere in the city, and maybe he knows a politician, but he'll also know the homeless guy on the corner. And it's just kind of like his ability to navigate the city is a skill, because...
Yeah, whereas the woman, the fact that she knows all this other stuff like that shows how seedy she is, but, you know, it shows how capable the man is.
Right, and that's an excellent point, that it kind of bifurcates, the morals when we're really discussing a man and woman having access to the same things and wanting the same things.
Yeah, it's very, like, old way of looking at everything, right? Because, I mean... You've got, and it is that juxtaposition of, you know, women were like, there's, go on Twitter and look up like World War II clips of women just shooting guns out of planes and stuff to test them. Cause I mean, like, they were doing that stuff. They were some of them were in the field.
100%.
And now they're coming back and it's like, no, get back in the kitchen and make me a sandwich. Yeah, it's like,
Rosie the Riveter,
dude, I killed
baby.
Three Nazis with my bare hands. Like, no, I mean, maybe they didn't necessarily get like fully in the field, like, before then, but I mean, just saying, like, you know, like I helped fight and kill the Nazis, like I did all this stuff.
All the propaganda of the war reminded you that like women in the factories were making the guns for the men to shoot, so it's all on a spectrum.
Yeah, so now you have this equality thing, and then what film noir is doing is going, no, that's actually a bad thing. Though these women that want to be independent and want to do all those things, they're femme fatales, they're fatal women. They're Eve.
They'll kill you.
They're all treated like Eve because they have the same knowledge and skill as the men. And that is...
And desire.
Yeah, and desire. And they're sexual. And, like, that's a guy thing. You know, that's supposed to be us. And now look at them. And look how evil she is when she does this stuff. Because now that she can think and act like a guy, now she's... When really we should be going... Maybe the way guys are acting is evil.
Yeah. Well, what is the toxic water these men are drinking from?
Yeah, like maybe we turn them into this because we did this for so long, and now women are doing it to us, and we feel bad because we feel like them, and we can't do anything about it because it's justice. We didn't do that. We went, no, quick, murder her and throw her in a pool and then kill the guy that loved her. But like when you kill him, make sure that he sees her die first.
Maximum pain.
Because they need to be punished because he like totally is on board with her having equal rights. And he's just this little seedy bank guy that wants to like take him away from this macho Ayn Rand capitalist guy. And like, how dare he? See, this is how things are supposed to be. Now let's cover up the evidence and leave.
And it is seemingly that easy in these movies where you just call a guy you know and they'll make it go away or something. And Something else interesting, Pete, I wanted to point out about film noir. A lot of people will think of the music, right? The soundtrack, because that's a huge part of the mood. I mean, a movie score, if it's really good, is there manipulating your feelings, but you don't notice it. It's just taking you along with the film. Film noir does an excellent job at this, but I feel like everyone thinks of film noir, that the music as like jazz, right? Which I love, right? Horns, brush strokes on the drums, maybe some scat singing. But actually classic film noir until the 50s was using kind of like string instruments, Hollywood score sounds. Now they were a little more dramatic, a little more severe. Because of the tone of the films. But yeah, a lot of people think of the image of, because in the 1950s, film noir became so influential that television, right, which was a new art form, and we're going to talk about that. But TVs were becoming more and more affordable, so they're going in people's houses, and how TV was made starts affecting how the film was made. And the TV noirs went with the jazz scores because it was the 50s, jazz was coming in. Those were the people in the cities who you'd want to work with. But yeah, it's just interesting because a lot of times when a genre like this, right, film noir, it signifies, like we keep saying, it's a mood, it's a temperament. There's these cliches or archetypes in this. And so you start, if you watch a series of them, they some of them hit the same beats, and you can almost interchange the main guy, right? Because they're all kind of doing the same thing. But I just really think if you, next time you're watching noir, listen to the music and what it's trying to tell you, because it's fascinating. And some of the best people in orchestral work and later in jazz are doing noirs. It was like a badge of honor to work in these. And I mean, we see this, listen to the theme song on NYPD Blue from the 90s. It's got like those horns elongated and everything seems like it's on a back alley with, you know, it's raining and.
Or the Law and Order theme song. Dun, 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 dun.
Yes, yes, yes. Dun. And it pulls you in. You know what you're getting yourself into before. And this is all happening on a level in your head that's just identifying these symbols, these techniques in this genre. And yeah, we kind of generalize it, but yeah, I just wanted to point out that it isn't actually jazz that is the film noir music. Traditionally, we're talking about strings. So it's a interesting little nuance. As far as the term film noir, because we get some nuance here too. If you read into this enough, you will see that there is huge debate over where the term came from. But let's look at 1946, because this is when French critic Nino Frank is often cited as innovating the term film noir. Closer readings will actually show us that this is only partially true. As with all events and eras, this must be understood in the context of its time. So we're going to look at it. Nino Frank's article, which was called A New Police Genre, The Criminal Adventure, was written in reaction to the French finally being able to import and view a slew of Hollywood films that were made during the Nazi occupation of France, the Vichy government. And so now, after the war's over, all these films flood into the European markets, and you have a bunch of people going to the theaters and taking them in almost as one compressed, like, what has America been up to the last 6 years with these films? And some of the films are John Huston's Maltese Falcon, which is oftentimes cited as one of the first noirs. We get Otto Preminger's Laura, Edward Dimitrich's Murder, My Sweet, Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity.
I love Double Indemnity.
So good. It's so good. It's probably the pinnacle of early film noir.
Yeah, for me, that's up there with that
it's
banker.
It's so good.
Yeah.
And that's Billy Wilder. Like 6 years later, he did Sunset Boulevard, which is kind of a really great mid-noir. It's not quite noir because it deals with a writer and he falls in with this aging Hollywood actress. But what she puts him through and what he puts her through it's the noir ringer we're talking about.
Oh, that's the movie where she's like having like almost like a psychotic break where she thinks she's still this gigantic star when she's like a nobody.
From the silent era. But yeah, her line is the movies. I didn't get small. The movie, or what is it? I can't do it if I can't do it.
I didn't get small. The movies got too big for me or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh God, I can't remember that line. That's going to bother me. I got to look it up.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to look it up, everybody. Give me a second. No, I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Okay, yeah, because the main character is saying, like, you're not even a star anymore, and she strikes back, I am big. The movies got small.
And it's like, that doesn't mean that shows you how crazy she is, because the movies are actually 10 times bigger.
Yeah. But that film's from 1950, and it actually goes to kind of things we talked about in the last couple weeks when movies went from silent to sound. There was a whole generation of actors and actresses who didn't have the voice or the acting skills for this new sound era, that because they were over exaggerating and they talked all dramatic, and she was in the movie. She plays one of these characters who basically gets aged out of Hollywood, and her voice isn't pleasant enough to be in the soundies. And so she retires with her money and wealth and her butler. And it's just it's a great look at Hollywood decay. It's a noir in kind of a meta sense, because it's a Billy Wilder using a writer as a main character, looking at kind of this underbelly of old Hollywood and how it is, informs the modern Hollywood. And it's definitely a play in the noir conventions that isn't like, it's not a private eye looking for a murder, although the movie opens up with him being murdered and he's narrating his own body floating in the swimming pool. It's a great movie. If you have not seen Sunset Boulevard, you should definitely go watch it. But all the films I mentioned, they present and I'm going to quote the article, they present a rejection of sentimental humanism, the social fantastic, and the dynamism of violent death as being a baked-in similarity. He also notes that America seems to have a fascination and tendency towards criminal psychology and misogyny. Frank understands this to be a part of to be apart from previous Hollywood detective and gangster films. He saw those movies, this new slew of films hitting Europe. He didn't see them as distinct from old Hollywood, but he saw them as maybe like a half of a deviation, that there was something new that had been introduced here. The nuance with the term, because you could say, well, why are we talking? Who cares who invented the term film noir? We all know what it means now. Well, actually, we don't. That's the thing with film noir. It is tough to talk about. And it has political undertones, the word. At the time, Frank was writing for it was actually a socialist publication. There was a second guy who in the winter of 1946, his name was Jean-Pierre Chartier. He wrote a piece for a conservative leading magazine called Revue de Cinema, and he noted that these new films were marked by pessimism and disgust for humanity. And now it's interesting, because the term it can go either way. Is this a way of showing reality, or is this a way of showing misanthropy, right? Tendency to hate humans. I mean, they were arguing about it at the inception of this word, and it's interesting. Because this genre seems so fraught with debate, which it seems perfect for the world of film noir. But what we have here, so that was 1946. There's actually a film historian, Charles O'Brien, and he did extensive research on this. He found that the French film reviews and the newspaper articles from 1938 and 1939 were using the term film noir. He found French film reviews and newspaper articles from 1938 and 1939 that used the term film noir at least a dozen times. In 1938, a film review penned by François Vinelouy, some French, there's a film called The Puritan. It is O'Brien's implication that the term was originally designed by the political right wing as a term of denigration for this emerging and evolving genre that had roots in French poetic realism, which we talked about a little bit last week. You get Jean Renoir and Michel Carnet are making these films.
Yeah, we briefly touched on it last week.
Yeah, and they were coming from basically an intellectual leftist standpoint. You'll hear this as the left bank in France. And so these writers on the right wing were looking at this new strain of film, and they were denigrating it by saying, this is black film. This is the coal of these people are the bane of our existence. It's sullied. Our country is sullied, and that these people are propagating the wrong values and morals.
It's kind of a fun joke to be like, oh, Americans, we're all about being American. But that's not necessarily true. Like, we look at ourselves and go, well, actually, I'm Irish.
Yeah.
And this and that and Italian and Norwegian and Swedish. And when you're in France, you're French. And when you speak out against France, sometimes you're viewed as speaking up against like French culture and French this, because their identity is tied to their nationality. So when you're criticizing the national,
Demeanor, basically.
Yeah, demeanor, health, whatever, the conservative side is going to go, you're against France. And when they start fighting, they really start fighting. They the streets run red. Like, they just, like, you're gonna do what? They just shut down Paris for a weekend and just set off your car on fire like the Eagles won the Super Bowl again.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to get to it, but yeah, look up Paris 1968. It's wild. Yeah, the thing about the French is, and the American standpoint is that they're somehow these like, wimps or something that they're not going to stand up for themselves, but they do so way more than Americans do. And take a look at the French Revolution. It was actually far more progressive than the American Revolution. But I just want to point this out because America, like, if you remember, Pete, because I know you're my age, Freedom Fries, right?
Oh, yeah.
When Republicans, yeah, they didn't like the fact that the French were like, no, that you guys figure your stuff out. Like, we don't want a part of this war, which we're mm-hmm. still in, the wars in the Middle East after 9/11. And so Republicans in Congress were like, well, we can't call them French fries. They're freedom fries. And it's not French toast. It's freedom toast. Like, we were trying to recolonialize these food products that have French in the name, and we had to make them manlier. Like,
and how ironic that we were trying to out-colonize the French. How dare you do that to us? We do that to everyone else.
That's an excellent point. How much twisted.
We want our statue back.
But yeah, it is important to, like, these things still happen, right? I remember being in high school and talking about freedom fries in French class, and it was just like, it seemed very stupid to me at the time, but like, our politics and our government now are it's the same thing as back in the day. You're going to get people, if you want a bill going through, everyone thinks the GI Bill of Rights, like, that everyone in Congress just welcomed these people home. It's like, no, that bill was fought over. So certain people tried to take out unemployment benefits. They didn't – some people had to be convinced, yeah, that given returning soldiers an extra $20 a month was a good thing for the economy. And of course it turned out like it saved the economy probably, but there were people on the other side of this who were trying to take things away, who were looking not in the interest of these soldiers, but in the interest of themselves, or of this American ideal that we put above our heads, but we don't enact and we don't hold ourselves accountable to.
And I think a lot of with film noir, you get that sense of, you know, not everything is what it looks like, right? When you're talking about, especially when a lot of them deal with Hollywood, right? Because you're talking about like the aesthetic and appeal and image of the American dream or Hollywood or this or that. And then it's all the stuff underneath, you know, like the camera follows the actor off the stage and goes in the back and they take off their makeup and they're miserable. Like, that's the stuff you see in film noir that wasn't being censored out in the same way that a lot of the explicit violence and drugs were. So you can see some instances of social commentary, but it's very subtle and you have to really be looking for it. And it's usually done with camera work, not necessarily with lines. And it's implied, like what you said with the lights, you know, when you're talking about certain particular scenes. That's why the visual style, I think, is so important when it comes to film noir, with the lighting and the way the angles are and the way the actresses and
so
actors
defining.
Look and everything, because this is the way we can say it. This is the way we can communicate what we want to communicate without communicating it, because all they actually care about is what they are physically seeing and what they are physically hearing. And that's where you can start playing is, well, where's the subversion? That's where Shakespeare played. Where's the subversion? It's in those instances of repression where art somehow wiggles itself out and like dislocates its thumb.
The quiet moments.
And does the magic trick and you're out of the handcuffs like Houdini and they're applauding you for it. Like that's where those magic tricks come in. And noir, I think the draw to it still to this day is when you look at it, that is there. When you really look, yes, are there problems with it? Absolutely. When you look at the psychological and historical stuff that went along with it, absolutely. What people draw in, though, is there were as many of those issues. There were as many of those films actually trying to say something about it, actually trying to do something about it, actually trying to expose it. Yeah, you have to learn the language of the film because they had to speak a particular way.
You kind of have to learn the language, though.
And this isn't something that goes away. Right. This is something that continues to this day, you know, and sometimes it's a little more on the nose because the message is more on the nose. And sometimes it's a little too subtle.
And yeah, that's interesting because we talk about whether film noir, like what distinguishes a noir from a neo-noir. To me, it's like anything after 1960 isn't in that first noir pocket. I just think it's kind of a defined time that was informed by the politics of the day, the post-war era, dragging out of the Depression. We have civil rights not quite being breached in the everyday world. But there are elements that are all there. They're all at least on the fringe. Sometimes they're at the center of these noirs, but it's about how the people around them navigate this. There's kind of a feeling of powerlessness. And you see it when you look at a film noir, the first thing you'll notice, it's going to be in black and white, a true noir, at least in my opinion. And those shadows are going to come through Venetian blinds through the window. And the shadows are going to cut through everything in the scene. And it makes everything have this feeling of doom. Like you're just waiting to be cut down. You're just waiting for that slice, that incision to go through and finish you off. Because there's just dread around every corner. And that's why in a noir, it's always raining because there's always that glisten. And it just has this look like this could be the last night of your life.
But you don't think that you can actually get that outside of that time period because of the political ramifications of like, this is how we're talking about women at this particular time. Like that sort of to you, it's no, this is a product of its time and that's it.
If I'm David Fincher writing Seven in 1997, if the whatever conventions that I'm pulling on from film noir, it's going to be a reference. It's going to be it's going to lose the bite that it had in its context, and it becomes a codified style, right? Like this certain type of dialogue. But like that was a type of dialogue because they were in the Hays Code and they had to say things a certain way. And you know, it was also I don't know if I mentioned earlier, but these were heavily informed by American hard-boiled detective novels. And so you get that kind of the talk, the dialogue, and it's kind of obscure. It's hard to understand, but it's because these are like little specialists in their area, and it's just a little pissing match between two guys over a girl a lot of time, with all this other stuff around it.
I would
it.
Love to sit here and argue with you about it, and I just can't. You're right. You're 100% right. I'm also of the inclination that, you know, there are post-noirs, that there's neo-noirs, that there's, you know, just like that there's neo-westerns. You can try to genre-fy noir, but it is so heavily influenced by the Hays Code, so heavily influenced by right after World War II and right before major civil rights movements start. It's so informed by all, like what does it mean to be a man? German expressionism, which would not.
In German expressionism.
Yeah, it doesn't really fit anymore. You can have really harsh, dark lighting, like great like blue filters and stuff that you can do with color film to give it a cold, icy, doomy, wintry allure. But I don't like when you're making something like The Lighthouse, right? Which isn't necessarily even film noir. This is more of like an old-timey silent era film. That's really what it would have been. There wouldn't have even been sound. That film doesn't actually fit within that time period. It's a replica of that time period.
Right, yeah.
And so like when you go to a movie like Brick by Ryan Johnson, or you know, if you Knives Out's really big in the news right now because they just got the sequel deal. Yeah, 2 and 3 for $450 million.
The two and three, yeah,
it's an insane deal. But those aren't, they call them whodunits. They call them noir movies, but it's neo-noir. It isn't film noir, and it is informed by those films, but it is also informed by today's standards and today's world, and those people feel like, I love the movie. I love Knives Out. I love the characters and everything, but it doesn't feel like they're real people.
Oh, it's so one of my favorite.
It feels like a stage play because it's so stylized, and that's exactly what it's supposed to be.
It's a stylized version, yes. Because when a director wants to do something like Knives Out or Brick, I mean, Brick's great because Rian Johnson's great, but he puts all of the noir stuff into a 17-year-old Joseph Gordon-Levitt's mouth while he's in high school. And so what the you understand you're not watching reality, but it's compelling because the style is it's a complete transplant into a high school. But to me, it still doesn't make it like a true it would still be a neo-noir to me because the things they're talking about in that movie are more modern problems. It's talking about, high school kids ODing on heroin. Yeah. And it's not like they weren't problems back in the 40s. They just weren't what noir was about. But
you weren't allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. So you can borrow these conventions, but I mean, maybe it makes me a purist, but to me, 1940 is when, and I alluded to it in the opening, it's when we get Casablanca, and it's when 1941 is when you get Citizen Kane. Now, these traditionally aren't considered film noirs, but without those two films, you don't really get the film noir template because when they made Casablanca, they then remade that with To Have and Have Not. They did Key Largo. There was a series of films with the same principal actors. You get Bogart, you get Sidney Greenstreet, you get Peter Lorre in a room. You have them argue. Someone gets shot. Boom. It's a movie. And that's like Casablanca did that. And if you think about Casablanca, that was before America was in the war. It was 1940. What Rick in the Humphrey Bogart's character, he is offering this middle ground. His American cafe in Casablanca is supposed to be like a neutral place, but it was up to him. Actually, the main character, in my opinion, of that movie is the dashing communist who's coming, fly by night through Morocco. But
of course you do.
Yeah. he's so charming, and he gets the girl at the end, and Bogart understands. He assesses the value of that guy, the value of that relationship, and that it wasn't worth it for him to try to take her away from a project that was bigger than him. And to me, that was a move that's one of those things we talked about. It was kind of a pro-Soviet move, right? Before everything had turned anti-Soviet, you're saying like, it's cool. The communist, he's okay in this picture. He might even be the good guy, or at least he's complicated. And I really like that about Casablanca.
I think that that's not necessarily a noir because it's not a tragedy. That I mean, it's a tragedy in the sense that Bogart doesn't get the girl, right? But he's doing it for the right reason. Like, he's not a washed up whatever to me. Like, he's just a different kind of guy.
He's actually really successful in that, and he knows everyone. Yeah, and it's because
he's more sure of himself and more powerful than a lot of other main characters in noir. So, do I think that you get some central players from Casablanca and maybe some musical cues or some line cues? Yeah, sure. I don't think you get film noir. I think you get more of that from Citizen Kane. Personally, I think visually Citizen Kane is much
more noir. That's with the camera.
And yes, that story is 100% a tragedy. Like, no matter what that guy does, no matter how crazy Xanadu can get, doesn't matter. Like, he will never get that sled back. Like, that feels more noir than Casablanca. Casablanca is like a superficial noirish thing. It has the style.
That's still coming out of melodramatic costume dramas almost. There's an elevated feel to it. Like, it's a nice night out. But there's some
there is intrigue. A Hollywood like glamour to it that you don't have with noir, which I think a lot of people, misunderstand and say, oh yeah, no, like the glitz, the glamour of the 40s. That's not really what noir was about. Noir was about deconstructing that and showing everything underneath it. And then all the other big movies that I think a lot of people go like, oh yeah, and film noir aren't actually film noir. They're like whodunits, or they're comedies, or they're this or they're that, and they have like a clip and it's a guy in a fedora in a suit, and they're like, oh yeah, it's got to be.
And it draws on, yeah, some imagery that you're familiar with from noir.
But like that's to your point. You can just dress up like a 40s person and walk around with a weird accent, and people be like, oh yeah, film noir.
Well, and
but that's not what it is either.
That's the movie, the one you're referencing, Touch of Dark, Touch of Evil, which is Orson Welles. So in 1941, he did, like we said, Citizen Kane, which visually it went a long way to bring those storytelling visual techniques. It went a long way to kind of make, I keep saying codified, but it became part of the language of film. And I mean, it's almost silly stuff. Like he's the first guy to show a toilet in a movie, right? Or the roof, there's this ceiling, but
yeah.
What that's saying is that he got so low on an angle that you saw the ceiling. And so think of how stark that must have looked. It's not actually like, oh, cool, there's a ceiling. Like you see that on film now. No one cares. It's the angle he's getting.
And yeah, and this how big movie, the camera was at that time, which was like, you know, the size of a 50-inch like CRT TV maybe, like
right. And you're not moving these things around very easily. And if you'll think of in Citizen Kane how big and imposing Orson Welles is, especially by the end of that character's life.
Oh yeah, when he's running for president, huge. And like you see that big banner behind him and everything shots. Yeah, it's gigantic. It's insane. He said it himself, you know, it takes an army to make a movie. Back then, that's what it took, because you needed
he fully understood. Yeah,
you needed
the collaborative effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now you don't get that. Now you can go even more stylized than everything. But even then, as stylized as you can get with neo noirs, like I mean, like you could argue that Man on Fire, Denzel Washington remake from the early 2000s, you could argue is a neo noir. That is 100% not included in film noir, but it has all the trappings of a film noir. You know, it's got the destroyed alcoholic man who's trying to do one last good thing, and it doesn't really work out the way it's supposed to, and it's really this dark seed.
It's almost a suicide mission.
It is a suicide mission, and he knows it is. And it's a man on fire. And like that, if you want to know what it felt like to watch a noir film for the first time back when they were watching them, you can go and watch something like Man on Fire or Seven and for the first time. From our standpoint, and go, oh my God, like Requiem for a Dream. Like, you could argue
those
that.
Those movies are so harsh.
It is a neo noir. You could go, like, we could literally get on about this for another 2 hours. And I see both sides of the point, but I don't think it's like classic rock. You know, I don't think it's like, you know, over a period of time where it's like, you know, you're going to start hearing those songs like on a classic rock station, right? Like
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah, because now it's like Red Hot Chili Peppers, Nirvana, and Soundgarden, and everybody. It's not going to be, you know, like, you know,
up next on the new metal block here on 102.9 MGK. We got Disturbed Down with the Sickness. And after that, we're going to have Slipknot spit it out, but up first, we got a classic.
Tracked.
We got Crazy Town's Butterfly. Up on 102.9 MGK Classic Rock.
Come, my lady.
Come, my lady. You're my butterfly. Classic sugar, rock. Baby. Yeah.